This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Rapper gefeiert. Als Mensch im freien Fall.
Dieses Album ist ja super therapeutisch. Die ganzen Fragen, die ganzen Schmerzen.
Dein Probemonat, was Leben angeht, ist vorbei.
In Vertigo. Die Doku über OG Kimo und Funkvater Frank. Jetzt im ZDF streamen.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. In this week's episode, I'm delving into the underworld of Pakistani drugs gangs in West Yorkshire. On the 2nd of January 2017, police shot dead 28-year-old Mohammed Yasser Yaqub on a motorway slip road near Huddersfield. Their target was apparently armed and dangerous, a big-time drug dealer, allegedly with a record of using violence to get his way. That was not how his family saw him.
All I can say, I've known him for a very long time. Spent every single day with him, and I know he's not a person who would shoot at anybody.
He hasn't got a bad past because he's not been convicted of anything.
Yasser Yaqub's death was followed by protests on the streets of Bradford. And in nearby Huddersfield, hundreds turned up to a mosque for his funeral. As I watched on TV the crowds of grieving men and women dressed in Muslim garb, I marvelled at how such a religiously conservative community could contain within it such a dangerous criminal element. Because the fact appears to be that the drugs business in West Yorkshire is largely controlled by gangs of Pakistani Muslim heritage who use their community contacts to aid their criminal operations. How has this developed and how is it carried out? I headed to Dewsbury to try and find out.
Dewsbury in the 19th century was a very wealthy town. Three railway stations. Wait till you see the town hall here.
My guide is Danny Lockwood. Danny had a long career in local newspapers, taking him round the country, but beginning and ending here in West Yorkshire. He's the author of a book, The Islamic Republic of Dewsbury, an unflattering and some think jaundiced picture of elements of the Muslim communities in the town. But no one doubts that he knows the place. He takes me first to Savile Town, where 91.9% of the population is Muslim.
We're driving south now into Savile Town. The old Dewsbury working class that worked in the mills and the mines, that community that was used to back living and outside lavies, moved out and the migrant population moved in.
It looks intensely respectable here, Danny. I mean, it's nice houses, you know, cars in front of all of them and so on. Yep. You feel like you could be in almost any northern town anywhere, kind of mildly kind of middle class.
Yeah, you wouldn't expect to have gangs armed with knives and machetes running up and down these streets, hacking lumps out of each other in fights over drug turf, and you wouldn't expect gunshots to be going off. And if you did, you'd expect there to be a lot of arrests, wouldn't you?
You certainly would. You certainly would.
It doesn't work like that. This area doesn't get policed.
There are two parts of this town in which the Muslim communities, there are several, are visibly segregated. First, we explore Savile Town. We only see people in religious clothing walking the neat, tidy, unlittered, frankly suburban streets. This is not the poor part of town. Savile Town is mainly Gujarati Indian Muslims. Next door is the district of Ravensthorpe.
We're on North Road now. And we're coming into the neighbourhood where a number of our high-profile villains, if you like, reside. This is Sackville Street where I was born.
You were born in this
street? I was born on this street. And this is a really poor neighbourhood.
And now you can really see that this, because now you've got the rubbish strewn
and lots of places.
Overgrown gardens and so on.
Completely unlike Savile Town. Yeah. You will count probably 30 fast food restaurants on a half mile of arterial road. We're on the main road between Dewsbury and Huddersfield now. Basically, the criminal fraternity, based largely around Ravensthorpe, is actually the poorer Pakistani Kashmiri community there. You can trace, or you could trace, most of the community that settled Ravensthorpe down to four or five villages in Mirpur.
How had Danny become interested in Dewsbury's drug problem?
We're over 20 years now, and I was listening to a director of the National Drugs Charity, Lifeline, who said that the main difference in his experience between Dewsbury's heroin addicts and those of inner city London, Liverpool or Glasgow were that Dewsbury's were on average about 5 years younger. Suddenly I'm invested in this and I'm interested in it and I'm digging it, but I'm seeing absolutely no proactivity from the police or law enforcement, but I know that people are dying, yeah? That is why I, as a journalist, have made it my business to find out.
I asked Danny how the drugs trade in Dewsbury worked from transaction to banking the cash. He had a theory.
Now, this valley locally is called Sleepy Valley because the British bed industry is basically housed.
I didn't know that.
In Dewsbury and Batley, yeah. All of those old mills that we've been driving past, most of them now are used in bed manufacturing.
Tell me how this actually works, you know, the mechanics of it. How does the kind of the business side of it and the connection side of it make the drugs thing work?
Well, if we take the beds industry as an example, and I've got to be careful here, because we have some very large, very reputable bed manufacturers. But within that, there are operators who take advantage of, shall we say, the import opportunities.
Danny told me about one local group of men who'd been seeking import opportunities in Brazil and were caught trying to traffic drugs back to the UK concealed in audio speakers.
For instance, if you are sending and importing beds or bed frames from far and wide, there are opportunities within that.
Danny says it's not only some bed companies that are used in this trade.
It's one thing generating all of these huge amounts of money. You've got to do something with it. You've got to wash the cash. Well, we've just driven through, you know, a half-mile long stretch of Ravensthorpe that probably has 30 fast-food outlets. I've stood at the back of proprietors of some of those outlets and seen them on a daily basis cashing in £3,000, £4,000, £5,000 at the bank. It's a cash industry. It's very difficult to police how many takeaways have you done. I once went into a takeaway and ordered myself a chicken madras, and they looked at me as though, you know, what are you on about, mate? And they actually asked me to go across to the social club where I was having a pint, and they'd give me a buzz when it was ready. And I'm pretty sure they had to order a takeaway for my takeaway.
Dewsbury is well served with car wash businesses too. Aficionados of the US TV series Breaking Bad will remember that the anti-hero and manufacturer of methamphetamine, Walter White, laundered his unexpected millions through a car wash. Danny drove me past the hideous mansion on a hill bought and built by Dewsbury businessman and convicted drug trafficker Azam Yacoub, nicknamed Mr. Sparkles after, yep, you've got it, the car wash he owned at the time. Yacoub was arrested, charged, convicted and went to jail. So I wanted to understand Danny's cynicism about the police attitude towards Muslim community drug dealers. Why, for example, according to him, did the police not patrol in either Savile Town or Ravensthorpe?
Because they don't.
Why?
Because they just don't police these areas. They don't police Ravensthorpe, they don't police Savile Town.
I know people say this kind of thing, but why don't you police this like you police anywhere else?
Well, you tell me. All I can tell you is you can drive
What do they tell
here.
You?
They don't. You know, they may well raid some of these houses around here, as and when they have intelligence, but that would tend also not to be the local plod. That would be the regional crime squad coming in. Sure, there are a lot of Dewsbury's drug dealers in prison, and talk about them until we got blown in the face. But for every soldier that goes down, there's 10 waiting to replace him.
In the last 3 or 4 years, we've had the big scandals about grooming gangs in Rochdale, Rotherham, other places as well, which were characterised at the beginning by some people not wanting to kind of admit where the problem was located, but gradually they had to, and they did.
Yeah.
Has that, in your view, kind of altered the capacity of people like you to make this argument and have it recognised by the powers that be?
Strangely, I would say no. And the reason I would say no is that I would, my observation would be that is that that willingness to address the problem has been specific to that problem, paedophile grooming. Yeah, that atmosphere, environment of political correctness, that same, if you like, approach to community relations has endured in Dewsbury all these years. It, in our experience, it's been not so much paedophile grooming as the drugs trade.
I think it's fair to say that if you were to walk up to the average imam at the average mosque and say, do you think drugs are a good idea? Then he'd say, I think they're a really bad idea.
Yeah.
How does this square?
Well, this isn't a religious thing. This is a cultural thing, in my experience. And so I'm sure that those imams, they see that they have a drugs problem in their community. They see that their young people are being led astray. But such as they have concerns, David, they keep those concerns to themselves. They deal with them themselves.
Let me come down to a central question of judgment. How far do you think that something like the drugs trade and that form of illegality is strengthened by the separateness of these communities?
It isn't strengthened by it, it's dependent on it.
Danny Lockwood is, of course, just one man, and he's not a regional crime survey on legs. So we put some of his claims to Kirklees District Police, who gave us a statement. Superintendent Paul Jeffrey told us that in the last 12 months, police have made 59 arrests in Dewsbury and across North Kirklees for offences connected to drug supply, conducted 97 stop searches for drugs, searched 31 premises, and seized more than £50,000 worth of Class A and B drugs. Most of their intelligence, he said, comes from within communities, and contrary to Danny Lockwood's claims, I quote, neighbourhood policing team officers do carry out visible patrols in all parts of Dewsbury and Murfield, including Ravensthorpe, investigate some drugs offending, and receive regular intelligence from residents. Now in the briefing room, I have two experts with considerable pedigrees to help me. Dr. Mohammed Kazim spent 4 years getting to know drug dealers on the streets of Bradford, hanging out with them by night and watching drugs change hands around him. Mohammed's research forms the basis of a forthcoming book on the Pakistani drugs trade. Also with me here in the briefing room is Tony Saggers, the National Crime Agency's head of drugs threat and intelligence. I could read out his myriad authorships and studies, but suffice it to say he does know the drugs trade. Mohammed Kazim, if I could start with you, how did you meet the gang members of the drugs gangs and earn their trust?
Well, I'm originally from Bradford. Also, being a Pakistani and being somebody who's Muslim from Bradford, I found access to be relatively straightforward. I went to some of the same schools as some of the lads that I interviewed and spent time with, so having those experiences and knowing the same people often allowed us to make conversation on subjects which we all had an interest in.
What kind of people were the boys who sold the drugs?
Yeah, they were nice guys. Some of them were obviously aggressive. Some of them were just like your normal young lads up and down the country, aside from being Pakistani and Muslim.
And selling drugs?
And, of course, selling drugs.
And what kind of drugs were they selling and buying?
Heroin tended to be the main drug that they were involved in. Aside from heroin, crack, cocaine and cannabis, most of the drug dealing was conducted over the phone. So they would have a phone call from the addict, they'd meet the addicts within the community somewhere, and then they would go and supply them with the drugs that they required.
And how did they get hold of these drugs in the first place? Who was selling them to them?
There was a wholesale situation. So you'd have the older dealer selling to the younger ones, and then the younger ones would go on to sell on the street level
So the older dealers got their drugs from somewhere. They then sold them to the younger dealer. Where were the older dealers getting their drugs from?
What I gathered from my research was that a lot of the heroin that was coming from down south, Turkish connections, were the main sort of link.
Did you get the impression that there were other groups who were selling drugs in Bradford, or had the Pakistani groups more or less, if you like, cornered the market there?
Difficult to say, because within some of the areas around Bradford, there are white young men involved in drugs. There's black young men involved in drugs. And this is a stereotype that sometimes people like Danny seem to perceive, that the drugs market is controlled solely by Pakistani Muslims, which, although there are lots of Muslims and Pakistanis involved in drugs in Bradford, they're not the sole traders. But then you have to look at the demographics of Bradford. Bradford is a city which has the largest number of Pakistani Muslims in the UK. So, understandably, there will be lots of Pakistani drug dealers in a city where there quite a large proportion are Pakistani Muslims.
Now, Mohammed Kasim, I want to come to you later to what the wider communities would make of this kind of trade, but I want to turn to Tony Saggers before that. Tony, you've heard both what Danny Lockwood was saying about Dewsbury, and you've heard what Mohammed Kasim was saying about his experiences in Bradford, so you're able to reflect upon what that tells you and how it ties in with your experiences elsewhere.
Sure, absolutely. And I think there's probably a couple of, well, one caveat and one point to make, really, in response to what we've heard so far. There's a big difference, obviously, between Pakistani communities and Pakistani criminals. But I think the important thing to remember is that with all criminals, they will tend to place themselves and hide themselves within legitimacy and what looks the norm. So it will therefore not surprise anyone to know that Pakistani criminals actually take advantage of legitimate, law-abiding Pakistani communities in order to place themselves covertly in amongst society. So that's the first issue. You would expect to find Pakistani criminals in Pakistani communities. And the other issue is that, yes, there are a range of nationalities involved in heroin trafficking into the UK, British, Pakistani, Western, East African, nationals from near Europe, Albanian and various other origins. But what's been described so far is not a surprise to me. You've got a situation that is representative of pockets of activity around the UK. And I guess to understand it properly, you need to go back to source to look at where the drugs come from and why are certain people involved.
Tony, can you just explain to me how the heroin gets into the country in the first place?
Into the country in the first place. So the origin is Afghanistan, almost certainly. The most common routes at the moment, as we evaluate them through intelligence and assessment, is Indian Ocean down through East Africa, South Africa, and trade routes back towards Europe. So that would commonly be down through Pakistan or Iran, through Iran across to Turkey, which is for centuries has been East meets West sort of trading location, and then through the Balkans from Turkey to near continent Europe and into the UK. Direct flights, generally freight, more often commercial flights than passenger flights into the UK, concealing in goods that are being transported. And obviously our south and east coast ports in terms of ferry activity from the Netherlands and France in particular.
Now, how important then in all that is the who that does it? In other words, where they come from, what contacts they have, and so on.
Yeah, it's very important because Afghanistan is not an easy place to access for any purpose. So having contacts in the UK that are criminal, linking into contacts in Pakistan who are also criminal, is absolutely integral because that allows them to access the illicit market of opium and heroin upstream.
We've talked about heroin. What about other drugs?
I mean, the geography is different for other drugs. You've got cocaine travelling transatlantic from Latin America. So the demographic of people and the nationalities of people that are controlling and are involved in that are very different. The drugs come to the UK, and again, similarly, the demographic of people who dominate those markets are different.
Danny Lockwood there was commenting about somebody from Pakistan who was actually apprehended in Brazil, which seems kind of quite cross-cultural.
Yeah. It's that never say never, because the reality is that the world is a much smaller place now than it was 20 or 30 years ago. So the movement and travel of people around the world is far greater. Criminals take advantage of that also, and businesses get exploited. So it doesn't surprise me that a criminal of Southwest Asian origin is operating in Latin America with a different commodity to heroin, because at the end of the day, it's all about profit and opportunity.
Mohammed Kasim, is this your experience too?
If you look at the number of British people around the UK who travel to places like Thailand and other places and try and bring drugs back into the country, we'd be here for hours trying to count the numbers. And nobody talks about them. Nobody talks about this being a problem amongst the British white people. Nobody talks about it being a problem amongst black people. But all of a sudden, we have a few cases, and this problem is blown out of proportion. Yes, there is a problem amongst the Pakistani Muslim group, but to be trying to say it's widespread throughout the UK is just totally and utter wrong. The majority of the Pakistanis are poor, deprived people. They live in communities that don't have a lot. They live in terraced houses. And, of course, there will be some amongst these communities that will turn to drug dealing. I mean, there's other reasons, the same reasons why young British white people are turning to drugs are the exact same reasons why young British Pakistani Muslims are turning to drugs. There are no cultural reasons. There are no religious reasons. If you look at the cultural reasons, why the question then is, why did the first bunch of migrants not sell drugs? How could you blame this on culture? How could you possibly blame it on any particular religious aspect? If anything, if you were to turn to the religious text, it tells you clearly that Islam is against drugs, intoxicants.
Tony Seconds, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, it's just to say, Mohammed, really, that our focus, certainly at the National Crime Agency, certainly isn't on a particular ethnicity or nationality of people. I think my point in relation to trafficking, and it is the case world over, is that when you have got drugs that need to get from one location to another, certain transit locations, certain access points become significant, and the trade and the contacts that exist between those countries are pertinent. And that's why, for heroin, East Africa linked to the Indian Ocean, Pakistan linked to proximity, Iran linked to proximity to Afghanistan, Turkey as a natural trade route into Europe, are all pertinent, and the Netherlands as a near-continent sort of trading platform. So, in essence, my point is that Pakistani nationals who are criminals, and that was my emphasis, do get involved in facilitating the trafficking of drugs from source to street because of access, proximity and convenience that's there to be exploited by them. So, but you're quite right, people from In the UK, I would say the UK has got the most multicultural drugs market anywhere in Europe. So there is no particular cultural focus.
Mohammed Kassim.
Personally, I've come across people who assume that because Mr. Hussein down the road is driving a £50,000 car, he's involved in drugs. He has a business which is not very busy. I assume it's not busy. He must be involved in drugs. I mean, there has to be evidence. We have to have this discussion in a way which we provide evidence.
It's very interesting that you should put it in this way, because the counter-argument which is put, and I'm not taking sides here at all, is that actually there is a degree of reticence. What you get is a mostly white police force that is terribly sensitive about any accusations of racism. And so the accusations that come forward are that it's actually extremely reluctant sometimes to take action against people of minority ethnicity.
I have to disagree again. Just today when I opened the news up in Bradford, there's a drug raid conducted by a Muslim chap who's working as a police officer. So these things are happening. No community is putting pressure on the police. If anything, Pakistani community wants the police to work with them and find out the drug dealers in their communities.
Your research was done amongst mostly Pakistani drug dealers in Bradford. What feeling did you get back from them about what their parents and what the community was thinking about what they were doing? Was the community as kind of desperately concerned about it as anybody else would be? Or did it despair? Was it fatalistic?
My research was in a tight-knit community in Manningham, mostly made up of Pakistani Muslims who had initially moved to Bradford to work in the textile trade. So this we're talking about the second and third generation of Pakistanis. And whilst the young lads I interviewed were actively involved in drugs, the parents' view was completely contrary. They were totally against drugs. To them, it didn't make sense why their kids were turning to drugs. To them, they wanted their kids to study, to become doctors, lawyers, and take advantage of the British education system. And there were cases, even when I was studying the lives of these young men, that some of them got arrested and their parents were distraught. Their parents were aware that their kids are turning in a direction which they didn't agree in. But they didn't know what to do. What could they do? Your son is selling drugs. Do you inform the police who come and arrest your son and sentence him to 5 years in prison? And, I mean, what could the elders do in this situation? And there's a cry amongst the elders who I've spoken to try and support these kids in turning towards a different direction.
Tony Sankers, you presumably you've heard accusations about lax drugs policing before. What did you make of that?
I work with police colleagues at regional and local levels, and they give the problem attention, not least because drugs linked to firearms, to money laundering, to other forms of violence, to corruption, to security at airports and seaports. So it's drugs alone is not the problem. It's what drugs brings to the equation that is often as much the problem. So what I do know is that across the country, the police respond to the drugs problem. I guess to what degree in what locations would depend on what other priorities and what other resource implications they're faced with. But I don't see any evidence that anyone's turning their back on the problem.
Do you think they have any intelligence, problems of intelligence within specific communities? And I'm not just talking about the Pakistani community, I'm talking about any kind of communities where the police are effectively outsiders.
I don't think so, no. I mean, the other part of my role is a bit head of intelligence, so head of drugs threat and intelligence sort of hopefully paints a fairly clear picture. And if anything, the biggest problem with intelligence sometimes is that there's so much of it that we have to prioritise to decide which we're going to deal with next.
Going back to a point that you made earlier, which I thought was well made, which was about the poverty amongst the people, the poor prospects amongst some of the drug dealers in Bradford. And it's something I'm kind of aware of in the depths of my own family history, which were of poor Jews who came to Britain from Russia at the turn of the 20th century. And for a while, in the East End of London, they were the criminal underclasses. Mm-hmm. You know, they were the people with the contacts abroad because they were coming to and from. They were the people who had no money. They were the people who spoke the funny language that no one else understood, and so on. And I suppose I want to ask both of you, isn't this just a kind of inevitable consequence of poverty and social change?
I have to agree. I agree with you completely. The Jews, if we look into history, the Jews were closely linked with poverty and crime and so forth. If you look at the Irish community, similar sort of experiences there. If you look at black young men. And I just feel that now, the current day and age, British, Pakistani, Muslim men are the next fork devil. They are the ones that the papers are talking about, the grooming cases and other cases of drugs and linking them with crime and papers are selling. And there is this, if you look at the real reasons of why they are involved in drugs, you will find that these reasons are the same for any group that becomes involved in crime. So my argument is that, look, it's not the Pakistani communities because of their ethnicity, because of their religion, why they become involved in drugs or any crime. And this is what we need to identify and then support this community to move away from perhaps crime and linking them with drugs.
Tony Sankers, does that make sense to you?
It does, but I think probably more than that, and without any need to repeat what Muhammad has said, I think the actual issue is there's a perversity going on here, that the drugs trade is extremely lucrative. It makes massive profits for those that are involved in trafficking. And regardless of your ethnic national background, people in the UK are making a lot of money out of the misery of others. And what Muhammad has described is the poverty that generates addiction. But that addiction is being fed by people often from the same backgrounds who are making hundreds of thousands, if not millions of pounds from it. And that's the problem for me. It doesn't matter what background you're from, it doesn't matter where you are. Society is damaging society through the supply of drugs.
Well, that's it for this week. My thanks to Danny Lockwood in Dewsbury, to Dr. Mohammed Kasim, who has worked amongst Bradford drug gangs, and Tony Sankers of the National Crime Agency. We'll be back next week, but who knows with what? That's it for this episode of The Briefing Room. If you enjoyed this podcast, you might also like The Inquiry, our sister programme on the BBC World Service. Just search online for The Inquiry BBC World Service. And if you'd like to give us some feedback on this series, there's an easy way to do it. Just review or rate us on iTunes or your podcast provider.
Hello. Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.